You're listening to Don't Blink, the Doctor Who podcast on Golden Spiral Media. I'm David Ward, and joining me is my co-host Wayne Henderson. So don't blink, don't even blink. Welcome back to Don't Blink on Golden Spiral Media. I'm David Ward.
And I'm Wayne Henderson, and as the testimony would say, exit your capsule, the chamber of death awaits you. Creepy!
Creepy. So this is such an emotional podcast and episode for us. It's the end of an era. It's the end of Capaldi. It's the end of Stephen Moffat's era. And what an amazing episode.
Yeah, and I believe even Murray Gold is moving on, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I think pretty much the whole production team is changing. So what we're going to get whenever it comes back is going to be completely new. So it was quite a ride. And I'm so happy to have our listeners back joining us just for one more Don't Blink About Moffat. And hope everyone had a wonderful, wonderful holiday and a wonderful new year. Sorry the podcast is a little late, but we want to talk a little bit of Doctor Who just for the next 40 minutes or so.
Absolutely. And what a Christmas episode it was. I guess it's officially the season 10, episode 13 finale. They called it Twice Upon a Time, which was very clever, made you think of fairy tales, as well as all of the things that went into this episode. Before we break it down, David, what kind of host rating would you give this episode of Doctor Who?
I am going to give it 9 out of 10 armistices.
Strong.
I think it's a nine. Yeah.
I was thinking about that the first time I watched it. Then when I watched it a second time through, and it just teared me up with happy tears and sad tears just as many times on the second viewing. Call me an old sap, but I'm going to give this episode 10 out of 10 Kleenexes filled with happy and sad tears.
Why not?
It's definitely one of the top three Doctor Who episodes, in my opinion, that I've ever seen. I know there's still quite a few I have not seen, but of all the new Who's, this one just ranks right up there and definitely the best Christmas episode I can think of.
You know, and there are problems with it, and we can chat about that. But, you know, I was talking to a friend about it the other day, and we started tearing up just talking about it.
So that you says know something.
Yeah, you know it's good drama when, like, it has that after effect on you. So, although there were some things about it that I think were troublesome, just the overall like vision of this was terrific. And of course, you've got one of the best Doctor Who directors that we've ever had, Rachel Tilley, directing it, which doesn't hurt. And I saw this at the theater for the second time. And it's obviously in HD and whatever, and it looks absolutely extraordinary. So even if the story is a little undercooked, just for a piece of visuals, it's amazing.
Yeah, and I didn't give out my 10 rating lightly. I thought, you know, comparing it to, because there were some episodes of The Leftovers on HBO where almost everything was perfect that I would give a 10. But the more I thought about this episode and the effect that it's had on people, its importance, and even with a few little dings here and there, it a far less dings than any episode in recent years has had. And, oh, I did want to, before we dig into the episode, ask you about the experience. You said at the theater, of course, it looks stunning. And one thing, I wish I could have seen it in the cinema, because the only thing that drew me out of it and had nothing to do with the episode, just how BBC America presented it, is the commercial breaks just like came out of nowhere. There was hardly a fade out or anything. It's just all of a sudden we're in a commercial and I'm like taken out of it. And I'm like, okay, hang tight. It's going to get back. But the commercials were just jarring in this episode, at least to me.
Yeah, it's a shame because I've seen Doctor Who on BBC America, and you're right. It doesn't work. And in theory, they design the shows for commercials because they know they have to sell them overseas. In fact, if I'm going to be a super nerd about it, even if you go back to the very first episode of Doctor Who in 1963, the recording breaks, because it was kind of shot live, but not quite. The recording breaks were designed to be also like fade outs and fade ins, so you could have commercials. So it's always been kind of baked into the format, but at the same time, the BBC, the great thing about the Beeb is that you don't get commercials. So it's really distracting to watch them. And they put a lot into Doctor Who. And it takes the flow way away.
Absolutely. I totally agree. But the episode, the way it started out, it was so nice, you know, seeing some of those old clips from the 10th Planet, like what I got on the DVD that a family member gave me for Christmas. And then when it said 709 episodes ago, that says a lot. That's a lot of Doctor Who.
So what did you think of the 10th Planet? I'm curious, because I know I saw on Facebook that you were given that as a gift, and what a nice gift. What was your take on that?
I've really enjoyed it. I still have the final two pieces of it to watch. Earlier this week on Christmas morning, I woke up with the worst stomach flu. I couldn't even watch the Christmas special till the day after. I was just shot. So I've been playing catch up and just ran out of time, but it's still there in the DVD player ready to watch. And it was interesting how they went from the original episodes and then the episode where they recreated it with animation. It seems like they're always using the same company for that, because it had that same style as the one they released about a year and a half ago with animation.
Yeah, exactly. They have been. And there's a new one out, which I think is on a lot of people's Christmas lists, called Sharda, which I've seen parts of it, and it's terrific. But the 10th Planet is, I mean, that was done on such a shoestring, and you can tell. There's no disguising it. But to see, it was so cool for me to see it on the big screen, just a couple of little clips. Like, I never thought in my life I would be watching William Hartnell give that speech in a movie theater full of Doctor Who fans in America. I was like, this is great. This is so much fun. And then they bring the idea in that the reason he looks different in this episode is because he's half regenerated, which I thought was really great.
Well done.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought they would do like a time differential thing or something like that, but it was a different solution to it. And I'm really glad they did, because it would have really bothered me having him be recast. I'd constantly be thinking he's not quite the same. So I really like that they just gave us that little nugget.
Yeah, and it's interesting when Peter Capaldi's doctor, and they meet up and they're talking, and Peter Capaldi's doctor says that he doesn't remember any of these interactions with himself. And I know there's a good explanation for that. Do you happen to know why? Did they say it? Because I missed it twice.
They've constantly alluded to it. And in Day of the Doctor, John Hurt, you know, says when he's leaving to get back in his own TARDIS, I'm not going to remember any of this, am I? So it's kind of understood that when two doctors meet each other, they won't be able to remember it until you're the last incarnation that was there, kind of thing. But it's just a timey-wimey thing.
Oh, so, okay. We'll just write it off as that. I thought it was clever, though, because it really made you think. This episode made me think so many times because of how different Doctor Who has become over the years. And we talked about it on our last episode, David, watching the trailer. And when we saw the captain in the trailer, you were hoping that we would get the World War I Christmas armistice in this episode. And boy, did you. You must have been just excited.
Oh, yeah. It was, I mean, that's extraordinary. And it really happened. That's the thing. It's part of it's actually kind of baked into British popular culture and sensibility that occurred, because it was an extraordinary event. World War One was such a horrific occurrence, and that happened is beautiful. They really did play soccer. They really did give each other gifts of chocolate. And I'll tell you a story that I guess I'm slightly nerd ashamed of in a nerdy way, but a buddy and me, back when I lived in England, just on Christmas morning, we used to go and meet each other, and we would play soccer, which I never do. And we would exchange chocolate in honor of the armistice. And it just used to be the thing that we would do to remember that, because it was such a brilliantly humane, wonderful thing to occur. And I think once he turned up in like a German military helmet, I probably turned up in British military uniform myself at one point, because it was just lovely. It was just gorgeously kind and that fits in with the theme of the episode, and I lost my composure when that happened in that episode.
And the way it was shot for this episode was just astoundingly epic. It just looks so good.
Yeah, I don't know like how many extras there were in that scene, but it felt like it was one of the bigger scenes. And it just looked beautiful and profound. And the thing that really moved me, and I loved Mark Gatiss in this. I thought, because he's had a rocky history with Doctor Who, to my mind. Mark Gatiss was an actor in a David Tennant episode, and then he wrote several episodes that weren't all that top-notch, I didn't think. Which was a shame, because he's a genius at every single other thing he does. He, like, League of Gentlemen, even his documentaries about horror, certainly Sherlock, where he plays Mycroft. He's brilliant in everything, but Doctor Who, he's never quite worked. And this was such a great victory lap, because suddenly he was perfect. His captain was amazing. And what really moved me was, because I'd seen the stills where he and the German soldier were pointing the guns at each other in that, I guess, Mexican standoff. I don't know if that is an appropriate word for two people. But the fact that they didn't want to shoot each other was so moving, and I didn't see that coming, and it perfectly represented World War One. Not to get heavy, but that was what it was. No, neither side wanted to be in that battle, and they couldn't communicate that to each other because of a language barrier, and that also somehow seems to represent World War One. Gatiss played it beautifully, and that he was the Brigadier's father, or grandfather, I suppose, was such a moving moment for me also. And yeah. I jumped out of my seat when they said that.
Yeah, it was one of those things where we were hoping for it, and then as it got closer, we were kind of counting on it. And then when he actually said it, it was just like giddy, 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 giddy. And yeah, Mark Gatiss, so fantastic. I would love to have lunch with that guy sometime, because it just seems like he'd be a fun person to hang out with for a little while and pick his brain and just all the good things that he's done. He's really done a lot of wonderful things. And that armistice, even though, like you said, it's such an important part of England's history and your British culture. The way I first learned about it was, and I'm sure they taught it when I was in school, but I don't remember much of that time, but about 20 years ago, a country music artist here in America, Colin Ray, put out a Christmas album and had a story song that I believe he wrote that talked about it, and then it went into Silent Night. And so we went and saw him in concert, and he talked about the Christmas armistice. Now it's a true story. And it's just so strange that I would first hear about it from a country music artist, Colin Ray.
Oh, that is interesting. It is interesting. But what a strange part of history. And you have to remember these young men were stationed a stone's throw away from a bunch of other guys that they couldn't see, but they could hear. Just so poignant. Yeah, I love the character of the captain. I thought he was note perfect. And he played off of William Hartnell, or the First Doctor's character, really well as well. And yeah, that was terrific.
Speaking of terrific, there were so many terrific exchanges between our current Doctor and the First Doctor because of just how society has changed since the early 1960s, because there were all these little clever nuances, and all the times that Peter Capaldi's Doctor would say, "Stop saying things like that." No, he turns to Bill and it's like, "I don't know anything about this." But on the other hand, the William Hartnell Doctor did get one good dig in to Peter Capaldi's Doctor later in the episode, where he told him, "Why are you always broadcasting what your plan is? Why can't you stop boasting?"
Exactly. I love that. I mean, you know, that's how Stephen Moffat writes. He writes sitcoms, and so he writes those kinds of conflicts and dichotomies. William Hartnell's Doctor was really not quite like that. That's one of the things I know people grumble about. I don't care. I think it's fine. He in his personal life was somewhat prejudiced. Occasionally there were lines in his episodes where he was a little inappropriate, but not very often. And they did sort of make him into the embarrassing uncle in this story for comic effect. But it works, so I'll take it. And they were laugh out loud funny, like just watching like Capaldi's Doctor cringe. It was like such an episode in humility for him. Mm-hmm. And it's hilarious. It's like, imagine if you saw yourself when you were a kid and they just embarrassed the hell out of you, or a difficult teenager. That's what this is. And that really, really works for me. And I love that he's the oldest one, but he's the youngest one.
Timey-wimey, Dave. Timey-wimey. What'd you think of the display that the testimony put on, where they were showing the first Doctor all of the things that he will become and be known as the Doctor of War? I mean, he really, speaking of cringeworthy, he was pretty shocked at seeing all of these scenes of all the different versions of himself doing not their brightest moments, but like Capaldi said, you know, hey, to be fair, they left out all the jokes.
Yeah, that was a really interesting choice, because you normally have, normally the flashbacks are hero moments. And it was so incredible to go back to the time war and the guilt that the Doctor has, and to really shock that young man that's an old man by showing him you can do some terrible things. I thought that was I did not expect it. It was a very sideways choice, but I really think it's going to inform our new Doctor, who we need to talk about, my new favorite Doctor.
We'll get there.
Instead of just being a better person, and I love that too, that they're setting her up for such a clean slate.
Yeah, I'm very excited to see where Chris Chibnall takes this, hopefully in a different style, even though this episode was fantastic. A quick question: what is browser history for a Time Lord? I know. What on earth has Capaldi's Doctor been up to in those sonic sunglasses?
He was pretty quick to get those back. So you've got to wonder. It was probably something so prosaic that he was just embarrassed. Like he spent a week looking at watering cans or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah, because that's at least the second time that his browser history has been brought up. I think he told Nardal or Bill a couple episodes ago not to look at his browser history.
You've got to wonder what's going on there.
And speaking of Bill, she's back. Kind of, sorta.
Yeah. It was hard to follow. I mean, the first time I watched it, I didn't know what had happened, like whether she was back or not. I didn't really understand it. But just having her back on screen was worthwhile. And I just forgot how much of a presence Pearl has. Like, she just changes the screen when she's on it. And it was great to see her. And Nardoli as well. I've got to say, like, it was a cameo, but
yes.
Yeah, it was great.
That brought a whole different kind of smiles and comedy, because it was good to see him again, even though we originally may have thought, well, I've kind of moved on beyond Bill and Nardal, but it was good. It was so good. You know, he shows up, he's got his supposedly invisible hair, his glass nipples, whatever else he's got going on. Guy's a nut.
It was also because the other thing is Moffat could have done a real victory walk. He could have brought back, you know, Madame Vastra and Arthur Darvill and whoever, you know what I mean? They could have really gone that route, and that he didn't. I really liked it was much more restrained than I'd expected. I'm not the biggest Clara fan, so I appreciate that some people will appreciate seeing her, but that didn't really move me. But weirdly, seeing Nardal did, and I never would have thought that when they first cast Matt Lucas. So,
and we've talked about in the past how Stephen Moffat, he just can't let any of his companions not have a happy ending. So of course, this is, you know, why we kind of got the copy of Bill, the memory version in glass. And so we get a more happy ending for that. I loved seeing Clara again. She's not my favorite companion of all time, but I really enjoyed her. And the way that Clara was brought back so the Doctor could finally remember her, I thought was brilliant, because it was so sad in that scene a couple seasons ago where they're in the diner and he just can't remember her. And he's playing Clara's theme on the guitar. And I thought that was one case where we needed a happy ending. And it took all the way till this episode. And I'm glad we finally got it. That was pretty special. Just, there was so much special stuff in this entire episode. And Bill Potts kind of summed it up for all of us when her character says, letting go of the Doctor is so hard, isn't it?
Yeah, it was interesting. Now, I see with Clara, I never found it credible that he would forget her just because he spent so much time with her. Like, wouldn't he find something in the TARDIS that belonged to her, or wouldn't there be?
True.
Anyway, we'll let that go.
I tried to dig into it and I couldn't come up with an answer. Were you as surprised as I was to see that we had some Daleks, kind of? We had Rusty.
Yeah, Rusty. What was that? That was sort of the last character that you'd expect to come back. It was interesting. I don't know quite what that whole thing was, where he was talking about the Matrix on Gallifrey and then needing a Dalek. And I did sort of lose a grip on the plot. And I think I've seen it 3 times now, and I'm still not quite sure what was going on. But it's Christmas. You go along for the ride.
Yeah, I guess for whatever reason, the Daleks have the biggest hive mind database in the entire universe. And the Doctor very cleverly talks Rusty into letting him access it. Mostly because it'll just make all the regular Daleks upset. That's good enough to keep Rusty happy.
He's trolling the Daleks. So, can't leave them alone.
And because of all that great detective work, we learn about quote unquote heaven on New Earth and the backstory of the testimony. I was kind of blown away, and even was Capaldi's doctor when he learned the story, and he's like, wow, it's not an evil plan.
That was a lovely moment where he said, I don't know what to do when it's it's true. That was a very Moffat-y kind of concept. It reminded me of The Silence a bit, you know, where it turns out that they're, you confess to them and they're the perfect people to confess to because you forget that you've done it. Or the Tesselectors, who are sort of like these time-traveling justice creatures. Hmm. They're the ones from Let's Kill Hitler. It all felt like from the same mind, for sure. I wasn't quite sure, though, what was going on with the glass people and the testimony. But that's okay. Again, it was a Christmas episode, but I wasn't following it, but I knew it was coming. You've got a regeneration coming and you've got all kinds of other stuff at the end of the episode. So it didn't trouble me too much that seemed a little muddled.
How would you describe your reaction when we went aboard the first Doctor's TARDIS?
It's funny you ask. I would ask the other people I was watching it with for that answer, because I did make a noise. I don't know if I can describe it.
Oh no.
But it was a very happy noise.
Squee?
There was definitely a squee. Yeah. And then, but every time they did a close up of like one of the little widgets on the console that I know way, way too much about. Like, I was like, oh, look, it's that. And it's like, just shut up and watch the episode. That was sort of my reaction.
Even Bill was kind of floored by it.
Yeah. It's a classic design. It's so beautiful.
Minimalistic and bright and white. It's like an Apple product.
No, don't say that.
Well, bright and white.
The guy that designed the inside of that first TARDIS loathed the idea of designing the TARDIS, and he did it almost out of anger on a cigarette packet or something over lunch. Like, he just did it quickly and was like, there, it's done. I'm a designer. I work for Shakespearean Productions. I don't do this. And he produced almost the perfect sort of modernist design. Just straight out of the back of his mind. And I love that too. Peter Bukaki was the guy's name.
He just happened to have a strike of genius. I thought the best part, though, about that first TARDIS was some of the very nice, deep discussions between the captain and Bill while the doctors were off doing their thing in the center of the universe. The captain and Bill had some great heart-to-heart talks. More Kleenex had to be pulled out of the box.
Yeah, they did. And you know, Mark Gatiss was just absolutely pitch perfect in his performance and the decisions he made and what he was doing. And that mixing that semblance of naivety and intelligence and bumblingness and I loved it because it was just these little moments and it wasn't this big sort of spectacle. It was just really people being kind and looking after each other. How can you not love that?
Yeah. There were even some great exchanges between Bill and the first doctor a little bit later on. I would say this is my favorite episode of Bill. She wasn't one of my favorite companions, but this episode, Bill really got to shine from beginning to end, and I was very happy.
Yeah, I actually really did have a lot of time for her as a character and from a performance perspective. And I wonder what she's going to go on to do next. I imagine hopefully the big screen and extraordinary things. I really liked her in Thin Ice. I thought that was a great story for her.
That was a cool episode.
Yeah, it was terrific, wasn't it? But it was so great to have her back and have her as an anchor for the Capaldi Doctor.
And then the next thing you know, both doctors agree to finally regenerate, and then we get the regeneration. Brilliant. Hmm.
Yes, it was.
It was brief, but it was brilliant. Jodie Whittaker has arrived.
Yeah, I mean, it was just perfect. It was funny because you know everyone that's listening to this podcast knew who she was and that she was coming,
right?
I'm sure, but there was a visceral reaction that I had to seeing the gender change that I didn't expect to have. That was amazing, and it felt like what it must have looked like when you saw the first Doctor change. If you watched that episode back in the 60s, in what, 66, how is there a different person here? Like, we're so used to the idea of it, to have it be jarring again and really great, was such a cool experience. And, I think she's almost, my guess is I think she's actually going to be quite like Patrick Troughton, the second Doctor. I think she's going to take away. So you've got Capaldi, who's the first Doctor, the grumpy one, because they are very similar. And then you have the second Doctor and Jodie, who I think is going to be quite manic and fun and more like a underdog, almost like Columbo type character. That's going to be my guess, because that's what Troughton was. And I think Jodie Whittaker is going to do that. We'll see. I don't know. But my suspicion is she's going to have a real twinkle in her eye. And she just sold it. Like, how do you sell? I was trying to work that out from the reveal trailer when, you know, you see her walking through the woods.
Exactly. I'm like, finding her TARDIS.
I'm like, how do you sell a character in one look? But she did. And she did it again in the regeneration scene. And I was just like, I get it. I get what you're going for. And that's skill. But like I said on the last podcast, like, you watch her in Broadchurch, she acts everyone off the screen. And that includes someone like David Tennant, who is a real powerhouse of an actor. How do you do that?
Yeah, especially those first few episodes of season one. I was just like floored at the intensity.
So Stephen Moffat was, as we said earlier, was a very kind of sitcom type producer and writer who, and that's not necessarily a derogatory thing, but he thought in those dynamics where the points of comedy are. Russell T. Davis was as a writer and producer, was much more character based, unrequited love, loss, hope, normal people doing amazing things. He was great at that. And I think that Chris Chibnall is going to be a visual producer and showrunner, just based on Broadchurch. I think that that's where he's coming from, and based on the reveal trailer. So I think that we're going to get a very different next season. And I think it is going to be Broadchurchy in a lot of ways. And I think it's going to look amazing. So I can't wait to see what happens.
I am definitely looking forward to it. I'm ready for a change, although I'm definitely going to miss Peter Capaldi, especially after last season. But the regeneration itself, the fact that we got to see from behind Jodie Whittaker wearing Capaldi's magician's outfit and the ring fall off, because obviously her fingers are smaller than Capaldi's. And then she gets, like you said, the twinkle in her eye and the big smile. I don't know how many takes they had to do of that close-up, but like you said, she sold it. I'm on board. I'm ready to go. I know we have to wait, well, something like 9 months, 9-10 months, but it'll be here before we know it.
Well, it will, but I don't know when, though, because they've been very cagey about the actual release date. So it may be longer than we're used to, which kind of stinks for Don't Blink, because I love doing this. it could be a while. It might be longer than we're used to get this program in the can and set up. So I don't know what we'll do in the interim. I guess we'll see. But I think it will be worth the wait.
Oh, I do too. We definitely don't want to rush them during this very important process. Quality takes time. I know I'm usually impatient myself, but once it gets here, I think this will be another season 11, whatever it's going to be called. You're going to want to see it in the cinema again.
I agree. And also, I mean, the ratings were kind of falling somewhat for the Capaldi era. And that was sad. And I felt bad for Capaldi. I felt bad for Moffat. But it kind of had a knock-on effect for Doctor Who fans. Like, they make less action figures. You get less cool stuff. It was just a shame to see it kind of withering a little bit on the vine. And I think the BBC are really taking this seriously. So I think when it comes back, it's going to come back big. And I wouldn't be surprised if they now take that opportunity to make a movie as well. So I could be wrong, but would be interesting.
In the meantime, we should take all of these things that you've mentioned about Chris Chibnall and Broadchurch. And if you haven't already seen Broadchurch, folks, check it out. It is kind of dark in many places, a little disturbing in spots. If you want to see some top-notch acting by a whole crew of talented people, it's just a pleasure to watch, although a little sad after many episodes.
Yeah, and it's sort of like it's a slow burner, but it's the first series is a masterpiece. Yes. It's also kind of where I grew up too, if anyone's curious about that.
Oh, like, really?
It's uncomfortably so. It reminds me of home, and those landscapes are so familiar, and he captures them so well. So it's just, yeah, it's interesting. I absolutely watch. I think it's on Netflix. I'm pretty sure it's for free on Netflix if you have a Netflix account. And he's done some other stuff too that I haven't looked at yet, but I might check it out before the next season of Doctor Who. Supposedly he's a very, very professional guy. He is absolutely committed to secrecy. And so I think there'll be a lot less spoilers for the next season of Doctor Who.
That would be nice.
Yeah, already there's so much under wraps that, like, at this point in production, we would know about. Like, we don't even know who's writing the show at this point. Supposedly it's a writer's room. So rather than having individual writers come in and do an episode, another guy does another episode, another lady does the next episode, they do it as American shows do, where they just get everyone together all at once and they brainstorm it. Which is completely new for Doctor Who. And we don't know who's part of that process. But I think it's probably a good idea for a show like this.
I think, yeah, with a writer's room, if they're all diehard Doctor Who fans, I think having a writer's room could help avoid plot holes now and then, even though they can always say, you know, timey-wimey, whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, or the time war. You can hand wave everything away with the time war.
Why not? So that would be very interesting. With that, let's go ahead and check in with some of our fellow Doctor Who fans. We've got a voicemail. We've got some messages from our Facebook community, our Don't Blink Doctor Who GSM Facebook community. Lots of stuff to talk about, Dave. Let's fire it off with Sam from the Going Through Who podcast that's going through all of the classic episodes in order.
Hey there, guys. Samuel here from Going Through Who over at tscn.tv/GTW, giving my feedback for Twice Upon a Time. And man, what a Christmas special this is. It might, if you force me to rank them, might actually be one of my favorite Christmas stories to date in Doctor Who that we've had. Several things to talk about, I suppose. David Bradley, fantastic First Doctor. He managed to take what William Hartnell was without being an impression of William Hartnell, if that makes any sense. Yes, he played William Hartnell in Adventure in Space and Time. I always get the two mixed up, whichever the title was. So mea culpa if I did there. But point is, this time he played the First Doctor, and he played it beautifully. Whenever another actor takes the role of a doctor that has already been played by someone, they can either do an impression of the first actor, or they can do their own version of that doctor. And in this case, David Bradley played the First Doctor. He didn't play William Hartnell, and that's fantastic. I love it, because it still had these little touches of Hartnell, but wasn't so much that you kind of rolled your eyes and went, oh God, this is just an impression. Meanwhile, yes, the whole story as a whole, and of course, we all kind of figured that the soldier was going to be a Lethbridge Stewart. Who here did not see that one coming? I mean, come on. It had to be. There's no way it wasn't going to be. But going with the historical accuracies of the Christmas armistice and everything in order to be the MacGuffin that he uses to actually save the soldier, beautiful. And then that regeneration. Man, that regeneration. It was so good. Capaldi giving a speech like only Capaldi could. And then the doctor gets thrown out of the TARDIS, and Jodie's using her real accent. She's not hiding it. We have a northern doctor again. Oh, so good. And we have Jodie outside the TARDIS. It dematerializes, and now she's falling to Earth, and we have to wait. We have to wait a long amount of time again before we freaking get anything. Oh, well, this is the plight of the Doctor Who fan. Well, see you guys whenever we get back to it. This is Samuel signing off. Keep up the good work, guys.
Great feedback, Samuel. Thank you for calling in. I agree with literally everything you just said. Going Through Who, I've not listened to that podcast yet. I'm going to check that out. Going Through Who sounds like David Ward at 12 when I watched, I think, every single available episode. And if you're British, by the way, this might bring back some memories. There used to be this TV station called UK Gold, and they showed everything in a row that existed, give or take. But it was like transmitted for overseas troops. So the signal was really weak on satellite television. And what would happen is if it rained, you would get this weird interference on your TV. So like, I would really dread it if the weather was bad and they were showing what I hope would be a good episode of Doctor Who, because I'd be taping it. So that was my Who marathon as a younger guy, apparently in Stone Age times.
Whatever works, David.
Exactly, whatever works. And also the continuity announcements before were legendary, and a friend of mine did an internship, and so he was on UK Gold introducing Doctor Who, and I was so excited for him. That you didn't need to know. But what Samuel says is absolutely right. David Bradley, see, when I was a younger guy, you'd hear actors say things like, I didn't want to do an impersonation of an actor. I wanted to do an impression, or like an idea of them. And it always used to frustrate me. I used to think, no, I want to see an impersonation. And then I saw that movie, which was called W, which was an Oliver Stone movie about the president. And every single person in it does an impression of the people that they're portraying. And it's horrible.
Oh. That's understandable.
It just doesn't work. And so I get it now. Yeah, you need to do a riff or a sense of that character without doing a Stone Cold, like, Saturday Night Live sketch impersonation. And that's exactly what Bradley does. Kind of like Chris Pine in Star Trek.
Oh, yes. Excellent Captain Kirk.
He's a great Kirk. And it's Kirk. He's so Kirk, but because he doesn't try that hard to be Kirk. And also, I agree. Adventure in Space and Time, I always forget which way around the title is, and whichever way I say it, it's always wrong. Is it Time and Space, Space and Time? Well, I can't.
Whimey. Hard to tell. Whimey.
And then Jodie Whittaker's real accent. We didn't talk about that yet. I was so excited. Like, I don't know why. It just made me really happy because no one knew if she was going to go RP, receive pronunciation and posh, or if she was going to use her real accent. And it was just, oh, great. Here we go. This is going to be good.
And which one did it turn out to be?
So it's her own real accent. And I'm so proud because she has got the best voice and the most enthusiastic and infectious way of speaking when you see her on talk shows and so on. So it's like, great. I really wanted that to be the Doctor and we got her. So hooray.
Yeah, it is always comforting and it's got to be a bit of a relief when an actor gets to use their regular voice. Although some have done some great different accents, like David Tennant, you know, when he was on the American version of Broadchurch, they did season one and called it Grace Point and said it in America. And he did a very convincing American accent, but I guess he also has a few other UK accents. And as a matter of fact, Christopher Eccleston on HBO's The Leftovers does a very convincing American accent, so much so that when I played an interview clip where he talked about the show for my Packers fan podcast co-host, Troy, he had no idea that he was British.
Oh, really? That's interesting. Yeah, I know Hugh Laurie was the same. People didn't understand. I have seen or heard some atrocious American accents from very talented British actors, too. I will say that.
some of them on Doctor Who.
Some of them on Doctor Who. Yeah, absolutely. What are you, some kind of spaceman? It's Daleks in Manhattan. The worst one I've ever heard was in an episode of a show called MI5, or Spooks, as it's known in Britain. On TV, the worst one on film I can think of is actually Kenneth Branagh in Dead Again. It's a truly appalling accent, and I don't know how he got away with it. But it's funny. It's a strange thing. I mean, Doctor Who came back in 2005, and yet it was still kind of subversive that Christopher Eccleston would be the Doctor, and I suppose by some definition an authority figure with a Northern accent. But it was, and it's brilliant. It's great.
So is Jodie Whittaker's Doctor going to be the first one since Eccleston that has a Northern accent?
Yeah. Cause Matt Smith's accent is, Capaldi had a Scots accent, so that's about as North as you can get.
True.
Tennant did a sort of estuary English kind of accent, which, the idea was that he kind of bonded so much with Rose Tyler that he picked up her voice. That was the idea. So that when he regenerated, he picked up her accent, which is why they did a London kind of, oh, that's brilliant kind of thing.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So that was what that was. But yeah, so Jodie's only the second. I mean, Tom Baker, and a few of our listeners may expect me now to bust into a poor Tom Baker impersonation.
Do it.
Oh, Romana. That's terrible. Don't use that.
Oh, I have to. I've heard Samuel Lewis say that same phrase on his Going Through Who.
Tom Baker. But his accent was a very, I'm almost doing it now by accident, but there was a Liverpool component to it, but fused with a kind of more classic television at that point. Tone, which was very interesting. And it gives him that most incredible speaking voice that, you know, you could listen to him read the phone book. So accents, this is the accents in Doctor Who conversation.
There we go. Well, here in America, and I'm such a noob, I barely know that, you know, there's a difference between Capaldi's Scottish accent and what I would hear from Matt Smith on Doctor Who. So I know there's a difference there. The finer points, I feel better now. I know a lot more.
Well, it's funny. For such a small country, we do have a pretty broad range of dialect. But then you do here in the States as well. And wherever else anyone is listening, of course, they've got just those nuances out there that are fascinating and interesting. And diversity is so important. And that's why we need Jodie's accent and not a classic London accent.
Not somebody that sounds like Mary from Downton Abbey.
Exactly.
Well, that could be fun too.
Maybe that'll happen one day. Yeah.
I would love that as well. Regarding the regeneration, we heard from Ken in Chicago on Twitter, who said that the doctor should really have a quote unquote changing room because regenerations cause so much damage to the unprotected areas of the TARDIS.
Exactly. Or just like park it before you regenerate. So if you fall out, you're not going to be in trouble.
Or drain the swimming pool in Amy Pond's yard. It just so many dangers.
Well, it's funny that there was a great theory that I heard that was, because in the old show, they would just kind of go like they would just like crossfade essentially from one face to another. And that would be the regeneration. Now you've got these big explosions and everything falls over when that happens. And there was a great idea that someone came up with was that when the Time War happened, the Time Lords weaponized regeneration. So the theory was that if you were stood next to someone and they tried to kill you and you changed, you'd zap them. And I'm like, I'm quite enamored with that. I think that makes a lot of sense.
Interesting. Had not heard that before.
Yeah, it's one of those little things, but like those big explosive regenerations are new, but it sort of makes sense that actually if you are in danger, you would sort of create some kind of defense mechanism.
I could see where that could really work to your advantage and fight people off. Keep them away. You need your privacy.
Exactly. Unless you're in your own house and then it becomes a problem. Everything.
Oh, one thing at a time. Before we dig into some of the great messages we got from you in our Doctor Who Don't Blink GSM Facebook group that I highly urge you to join if you haven't already, want to play a promo for another podcast here on the Golden Spiral Media Podcast Network.
Journey into the endless realities of your mind with the Electric Dreams Podcast.
From the genius of Philip K. Dick comes a series of short stories adapted for the small screen by a creative team including Ronald D. Moore and Bryan Cranston.
And each episode of the anthology series will be dedicated to one of Philip K. Dick's stories. This series will expand the realm of possibility beyond the realm of reality and make one take a deeper look into their own existence.
Join Wayne and Steve on Electric Dreams Podcast
on Golden Spiral Media.
And that's kind of a shameless plug to promote my other show here on Golden Spiral Media, Electric Dreams, based on a lot of short stories from Philip K. Dick. But finally, January 12th, Electric Dreams is finally going to air here in America on Amazon Prime. England and the UK have seen 6 of the 10 episodes, and sometime in January or February, they're going to play the final 4. Canada is playing like an episode a month. I don't know what's behind that. However, almost everybody will get some Electric Dreams, so I want to make sure you knew that we do have the Electric Dreams podcast. And if you dig into the first 6 episodes, we've already got those podcast episodes out for you. So check those out.
Yeah, and have a look at the other shows on Golden Spiral Media, too. I mean, there is some great stuff out there. We're taking a break, obviously, because we have to, with Who. I'm sure if something interesting happens in the meantime, we'll do a special. We've got some interesting unaired material to air as well. So if you're not part of the Facebook group, join it. There are some wonderful people on that group. I genuinely do this to connect with our listeners, and they're great people. So be part of the Golden Spiral Media family. We are here all year round, even if Doctor Who is in Norris.
So very true. I mean, some of their biggest shows right now, Of course, Troy and Aaron do The Blacklist Exposed, if you watch The Blacklist here on NBC in America. And, of course, Daryl, the king of Golden Spiral Media, him and his daughter Addie do a podcast for Stranger Things, which is fairly popular. I bet you've heard of it.
Oh, does he do that with his daughter? That's yes. Lovely. Yeah. That's great.
They have a nice twist on it because she is such a diehard Stranger Things fan that she always binge watches the entire season the day it comes out. And Daryl has self-restraint and watches an episode a week. So they put out one episode a week. They just finished with season two, and they do a really good job. That father-daughter dynamic, and, you know, because she's a teenager, she's kind of got that angle. So it's good stuff to check out their Stranger Things podcast on GSM.
That's great. And not to go too far off topic, but I don't know if we do an Orville podcast, but if we don't, we need to do the Orville next year, because that show is, other than Doctor Who, I think one of the best things that has aired in years. So check out the Orville too.
Absolutely. And some of the comments, and I wanted to get your thoughts on these as well for the folks on the show. Todd Schwartzberg said in the Facebook group, okay, so Whitaker's doctor had it right. Brilliant. Brilliant Christmas episode. Loved that the big bad of the episode wasn't an evil group or even had an evil plan. So when do we think season 11 will start officially? New Year's Day? I wish. Hopefully, realistically, Easter, but probably September. Anyway, I give this episode 10 out of 10 brandies hidden in TARDIS roundels. Your thoughts?
Well, first of all, I think that everyone I watched the episode with was watching me look at that bottle of brandy and try and figure out what the screen accurate prop was, because I need one of those. And I love that, like, he like tells himself off for drinking his own drink, which was also kind of fun. In terms of the start date, we just don't know. And it could be a while. Honestly, I've heard like rumors from the production side of things that they might really hold this off. So we'll wait and see. And there's going to be so much secrecy. I would love it if there was an Easter episode. And I'll talk to you all then if there is. But I'm thinking if it's the autumn of this year, we may even be lucky.
Really? Oh, my goodness. I was thinking October at the latest. But again, we do want quality, and that might take time. That's just going to be hard. But you've noticed a lot of TV shows lately have really had very long hiatuses. Stranger Things, like we talked about before, they had a very long, well over a year in between seasons, I believe. And Westworld on HBO is going to have an almost 2-year in between season. So hang on to your hats, folks, and watch a lot more of the classic Doctor Who, because there's a lot of that. That'll keep you entertained.
There you go. Yeah.
Fred Firestein said, I enjoyed the episode and I was almost okay with the last half hour being a farewell to Capaldi rather than an introduction to Jodie Whittaker. There were a few moments of Moffat's trademark cheesiness, like don't eat the pears. And I agree with Todd from a moment ago that it was nice to find out after all, it wasn't Bill, but that was okay. And there was no evil intent. Moffat said in the farewell, he wanted to reunite the doctor with his memories, especially of Clara. There have been other regenerations in which former companions were featured. Now I guess we have to use our time during the hiatus productively with rewatches or discovering new stories from the extended universe of books, comic books, and audiobooks. And Fred, I thank you for that post. That reminds me, I think that's the way I'm going to go because I love audiobooks. I think I'm going to dig into the Big Finish stories.
Yeah, Big Finish. I'm not the... People like it, and I like that they like it, and I really like that it's happening. I don't necessarily think that Doctor Who works on audio, but there are some good ones out there. So I would also highly, they did a range of books in the 90s called The New Adventures, which kind of picked up from the Sylvester McCoy era. If you can get them, I think some you can just download. They are well worth looking at. You've got 26 seasons of Classic Who to go to as well. So we should maybe post some recommendations in the chat on our Facebook group in the meantime, because some of the stuff is really good. Yeah. Some of it isn't.
Uh-oh. As it comes to you, David, please go ahead and do that. I mean, there's all the episodes that are on BritBox, but as I've learned over the past 6 months, there are so many that are either gone forever or that you have to purchase the DVD because they have recreated a lot of stuff, and they do deserve their money for recreating the scenes from the audio. So more classic Who could be the way to go. And Jeff Gentry also posted in the Facebook group and said that he loved the regeneration scene, especially the ring dropping off the finger. I need to watch the episode again, and I am so ready for the fall and new episodes, if that's when we get them.
Yeah, and the ring is so symbolic because it's Capaldi's own ring that he wore.
Really? Is it really his own personal?
Yeah, because yes and no, but mostly yes. So he used to wear, he's married and he doesn't want to take his wedding ring off. And so in any role that he plays. So what they did is they commissioned a ring to go over his wedding ring, which has got those little, it's like a double stud kind of thing in it. And it was lovely because they, the daughter of the guy that made it was a little jeweler in the middle of England, wrote a whole backstory because she was a Doctor Who fan about what that ring was.
Really nice.
Yeah. Yeah. It's little things like that, isn't it? That makes this so much fun. So the reason he was wearing a ring was because you could say in universe, maybe it was Rivers. Probably not. I don't know. But in real life, it was a Capaldi thing. And so having that fall off his hand or her hands, excuse me, is incredibly symbolic of him leaving. And one of those little things that really got me.
Just fantastic. The more I hear about it and we talk about the episode, the more I love it and need to watch it yet again. Luckily, the DVR is always handy and there's not a lot of other stuff on TV right now, so I can do that. Two more great messages in the Facebook group. Todd Schwartzberg followed up. And this is good. We're going to need your help on this one, David. Do we think Capaldi's doctor left a voicemail recording for the next regeneration? Was that the button Jody pushed on the console before getting shook out of the TARDIS? Was the TARDIS trying to kick her out because, quote unquote, sexy doesn't like her? Or was the TARDIS trying to protect her of the cloister bells? Did Jody's doctor accidentally flush the fluid link on deck 42? I'm not expecting real answers, but these are all questions that occurred to me and are fun to think about.
Oh, we can give some real answers, I think. it had not occurred to me that he was leaving a voicemail, but yes. Because he was very pointedly, now I think of it, he was very pointedly looking at a certain spot when he was talking. He wasn't looking in the air and holding his hands up, saying, next doctor, do this and that. He kept looking at the central console. And bearing in mind that Matt Smith left a voicemail for Clara.
That's true.
It makes sense that he would literally be leaving a message for himself, which I really like. Fluid Link, episodes 5 of the original series, the Daleks, that's a big plot point. So Fluid Link does tie in with William Hartnell. And then the TARDIS, I wonder, there are so many theories as to whether Jody got booted out of the TARDIS, either because it didn't recognize her or more likely because it was exploding and it wanted to keep her safe.
That could be too.
Yeah. The bibliophile in me, and I'm not one of those people that's like boasty about books and things, but seeing all of those books fall out of the TARDIS really upset me more than her falling out, actually. I was like,
because we know she's going to be okay.
She's exactly. It's the book that I kept admiring those bookshelves during that episode.
And although we didn't see it, I have a good idea that the guitar is gone forever.
Yeah, I know.
It's with the books wherever they went.
That guitar, yeah.
That'd be nice to have. And Steve Sawyer, co-host of Electric Dreams, said, having 12 get to see how far the doctor has come since 1, and the testimony was gathering the essence of people before they die, decided to help him to decide to regenerate. Wouldn't surprise me if testimony wasn't a future doctor's idea. What do you think? Any chance?
You know, I think it's one of those things, they call it headcanon, where it's like, Do you know what I mean? Like, for anyone that's not heard that term, it's, they never confirm it on screen, but it's just what you believe and it works. I think that's probably, yeah, yeah, that's probably headcanon. And I don't know that they'll ever go back to it, but yeah, I like it.
There you go. Now, David, the, something you talked about earlier made me want to bring up our occasional feature of Britain versus American culture tidbits. I've learned from you over the past year that lemonade should definitely be carbonated like it is in Britain.
Absolutely.
I just need to find some. It's not very easy to find that way. But my question is about the brandy. Is brandy more common in the UK, or do you think it's was just more common in the 1960s? What can you tell me? Because I don't see very much brandy around, at least in my areas.
Yeah, it's both.
It's both.
Yeah. Because it was like a classically sort of old person thing to do. Like, have something medicinal, you know,
yes.
Would be the way that they would describe it. And I like a tipple here and there. But it is a fairly horrible substance, brandy, to my mind. But it is more common. Yeah, it is. You would have like a decanter with brandy in just in case someone needed to recover their constitution. I don't know how else to put it.
Cause I know on Downton Abbey, set back in around the time of World War I, they always seem to be having port.
Yeah. Well, yes. And sherry.
And if I had to choose, I would definitely go with the brandy over any of those others.
I don't know. A nice glass of sherry at Christmas.
But is the holidays. Okay. But port, I can't do port.
Yeah. Port can be a little bit cruel the day after.
Oh, so I just had to ask. I had to.
No, that's fine. And if I find some carbonated lemonade on this shore, I will certainly send it your way.
I think I just need to go to Amazon and just search. It's got to be there. I've found some amazing things over the years. So I can just find some carbonated bottled up lemonade. Wouldn't be the same as coming right out of a tap somewhere, but.
I didn't say it was good. I just think it's better.
Oh, okay. I shouldn't get my hopes up too high.
Well, if you, I would keep it on reserve in case you want lemonade and then have that.
Oh, okay. Thank you, David. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining on this episode. I just love talking about this episode twice upon a time.
I just say it was just a quirky thing, but the moment that I really welled up and it just was nice was when they have the armistice and the captain gets that whistle out and blows it. And says, wounded man here, wounded man here. And he's so worried about the guy's safety. And he wants him to be well. And I just thought that was extraordinary. And it just moved me so much. And that was the Brigadier's grandfather. The episode, I think, fundamentally was very forgettable. But there are so many moments that I just think are perfect. And so what a way for Moffat to go out. And I am glad there's going to be a change of producer. And I really hope they set some great characters up for the next series and bring Moffat back to write for them. Because then it will be everyone playing to their strengths.
That's an interesting twist I hadn't thought about.
Yeah. And I hope Russell comes back too.
Oh, that'd be awesome.
Yeah. I mean, let's get the all powerhouse writers back. I think that would be great.
And who knows? Maybe with the new showrunner and the whole new team, maybe a little later on down the line, maybe this new team could talk Christopher Eccleston to finally come back for an appearance on something.
That's a great point. Imagine that. Well, Matt Smith would do it. David Tennant would definitely do it. Capaldi would as well. So you've got like the five Doctors.
The new five doctors. I saw part of that special.
It's not so good, is it? I mean, it's
no, but it's cheeky.
It's yeah. I don't know. Oh, you mean the yeah. But this has been fun, and thank you everyone for listening to the show. I really love the Facebook group. I encourage everyone to join it. I hope we all get to do a meetup at a convention sometime. Thank you also to everyone that listens that doesn't send feedback or join the Facebook group, but just supports the show. We love you too. And a special thanks to my friends who are supportive of me and my bizarre obsession with the show. Maureen, Brian, Terranova, Mike, everyone that listens to this podcast. It means a lot. And I'm sorry we can't do more because there's not more Doctor Who, but I look forward to doing this again.
Absolutely. I can't wait. Once it happens, it will happen. And David, it's been a great season, and we're looking forward to next season. It's going to be totally different. But in the meantime, like David said, join the Facebook group, keep the conversations going there. And you can always tell a friend. If you get somebody else hooked onto Doctor Who, this new season coming with Jodie Whittaker, now's the time to get new people on board. And go ahead and tell them about the Don't Blink podcast. They can find us at don'tblinkpodcast.com. And, you know, it's going to be a long 9-10 months, maybe even more. That's a long time to not blink. Should we take the opportunity during those months, David, to blink?
No, don't blink. Don't even blink.
Thanks for listening to Don't Blink, a Doctor Who fan podcast, part of the Golden Spiral Media Podcast Network of shows. I am the Doctor in Utah, and the majestic tale of a madman in a box are used with permission by Silver Screen Records. They're composed by Murray Gold and performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by Ben Foster. Taken from the original Doctor Who soundtrack, Doctor Who Series 6, available on Silver Screen Records.